Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
Well, you seem awfully happy.
I'm happy to see you.
Oh, that's awfully sweet. We're still doing the show remotely. I'm still holding down the fort in Ecuador. You're in Maine, and your mom's surgery, by the time this airs, will have already happened. But as we record, it's tomorrow, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I have to get up very early. I set my alarm for 3:30 and grimaced as I did it because it's been a while since I had to get up at 3:30.
That must remind you of the days when you had to get up at that hour to do radio morning show news.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not care for it. I loved doing the news and I loved doing radio, but I did not love 3:30 in the morning. And it was even worse if it had snowed because, of course, the snow reports had to go out first. And that meant that I had to leave extra early, especially because it had snowed. So you had to give yourself time. I can remember leaving the house at like 1 a.m. one day. And I was like, this is not even the day yet. That's not today. It's still yesterday.
It's still yesterday. In my mind, it's actually several days ago. As a morning radio show host, formerly you and I can totally relate to that. It just seems counterintuitive when a big blizzard would hit. We were the ones that had to go to work and tell people, don't go to work. It's dangerous.
Yeah, it was important that we do that.
Yeah.
There was a time when our bosses would set us up at hotels near to the radio station. So that way we'd be safe if we had to travel that morning. But that was nixed pretty quickly when the hands changed. And
new company.
Which wasn't really a concern anymore.
Good luck.
Get a truck.
Yeah, we have video of me. You took it out the kitchen window of me driving like over somebody's fence and through their yard in order to get to work because a tree had fallen down in our driveway and they couldn't plow it.
I was so anxious. I did not think that you were going to make it. And you were like, nope, this truck could do it. Burp, burp, burp. Chirping Brody's and everything. Yeah. It was wild.
I'm a Mena.
I loved it.
I've got a story that I think you're going to really, really enjoy.
Okay.
You and I share a common interest in all things space related.
Oh.
This fits the bill perfectly.
Okay. I thought you were going to say someone got gored by a bull or something.
Oh,
and
well,
I was like, I am
too
interested.
Yeah, I enjoy that. There was actually something in the news. I don't know if you saw this. This guy was running with the bulls in Pamplona in Spain. And stopped to take a selfie with the bull.
How'd that work out?
Not so good.
Did it work out well?
Not so good. So, captured in the orbit of Saturn, there lies a fascinating world that captures the imagination of scientists and people like you and me. Titan is Saturn's largest moon. It's covered in a thick orange haze. Titan presents a mysterious appeal that beckons the question, could life exist there?
On Titan?
On Titan. Many scientists believe that it is very possible. Titan is unlike any other place in our solar system, except perhaps in some astonishing ways, Earth itself. It's the only moon with a dense atmosphere primarily composed of nitrogen and methane clouds that produce a constant drizzle. It's always drizzling methane, liquid methane. This makes Titan's atmosphere remarkably Earth-like, a feature not seen on other moons or even other planets in the solar system. Moreover, at the surface, Titan hosts lakes, rivers, and seas, not water, but liquid methane.
Oh.
It's a very exotic hydrology, and it sets the stage for what could be a very possible but different kind of life form. The potential for life on Titan rests on several intriguing aspects of its environment and chemistry. You know, when I started reading about this, I've known about Titan and been fascinated by it for a long time, but I just kind of wrote off any possibility of there ever being any kind of life being able to survive there because the surface temperature is about minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Not even my truck could survive that.
I was just going to say that.
The presence of liquid methane suggests a stable medium in which chemical reactions crucial for life can actually occur. On Earth, of course, water is what plays that vital role, facilitating the transport of molecules and enabling the chemical reactions that are necessary for life to exist and fundamentally alien to our water-centric understanding of biology. So if there is life there, it ain't gonna be like us.
Right. It's not gonna be carbon-based, probably.
Probably not carbon-based. Secondly, Titan's atmosphere is rich in organic compounds. These are complex molecules that include carbon, hydrogen, and often oxygen and nitrogen. These are key building blocks for life. Titan's atmosphere and surface interact dynamically with solar radiation and Saturn's magnetic field, driving complex chemistry that produces an overabundance of these organic molecules. Some of these fall to the surface, potentially feeding into any life processes that might exist there.
Uh-huh.
So what kind of life could exist in such a cold and forbidding environment? Life on Titan, if it exists, would likely be, as you mentioned, vastly different than Earth's life forms. Scientists believe that any life on Titan could have cells that are quite different from what we're used to. Instead of being made up of the usual cell membranes like ours, Titan's potential life forms might have something called azotisms. These azotisms are made from small nitrogen-containing organic molecules. Think of them as like building blocks that can handle the very cold temperature and methane-rich environment of Titan. In addition, life on Titan might use hydrogen gas dissolved in liquid methane as a way to gain energy by reacting hydrogen with acetylene, which is another common substance. These hypothetical organisms. I've been alone way too long.
Don't say it.
Anyway, they could potentially extract energy this way. So there's a couple of things that would play an important role in this. Number one, the cellular structure, as I mentioned. These hypothetical cell structures would be suited to contain, protect, and facilitate the function of a biological machinery in a liquid methane environment. A solvent system, were water-based, of course, but they would be liquid methane-based. Energy acquisition, we just covered that. So all of those things are there, albeit different from how our life works.
Right. That's wild.
So let's talk a little bit about what kind of life could happen there. Given the low gravity of Titan, about 14% of Earth's gravity, and the dense atmosphere, life forms might not need robust structures to support themselves. They could be larger but less dense, possibly floating or drifting in the thick atmosphere or the liquid methane sea.
That's neat.
Yeah. These big things just floating around. Movement could be quite different on Titan. Life forms might evolve to float or swim in the methane seas using appendages adapted for rowing or undulating through viscous hydrocarbons. In this atmosphere, flying or floating organisms kept buoyant by internal gas bladders or through lighter than methane body structures could be plausible.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gas bladders.
Yep. Gas bladders. With limited visibility in Titan's hazy atmosphere, life forms might not rely on vision as their primary sense. Instead, they could develop enhanced auditory, tactile, or even some sort of chemical communication and sensing mechanisms to navigate and interact with not just their environment, but with each other. Taking into mind evolution, here are some possibilities. The creatures would have some sort of complex coating or shells to protect them from the cold. Life forms might evolve insulating layers of shells made from complex organic material. They would have antifreeze chemicals to prevent their internal fluids from freezing. They could utilize antifreeze proteins and other chemicals similar to some organisms on Earth that live in very cold environments.
Yeah.
And synergistic relationships similar to Earth's ecosystem. Titan's life forms might develop interdependent relationships, such as smaller organisms living symbiotically with larger ones, exchanging chemical nutrients for protection and mobility, not unlike many relationships here on Earth. So how do we detect life on Titan? Yeah, with the current space technology, it would take about 7 years to reach Titan. The duration can vary, of course, based on specific trajectory. And, you know, for example, the Cassini-Huygens mission launched in 1997 that used gravity assist to help fling it toward the planet. And that could be utilized again. Of course, technology could advance rapidly in the near future.
And if you really hammer on her.
Just hammer on her, bub. NASA's Dragonfly mission is slated to launch in the early 2030s, and that represents a significant step toward our quest to uncover Titan's secrets. It's going to be kind of like a drone-like rotorcraft that'll fly through Titan's thick atmosphere when it gets there, and covering much greater distances than any rover could possibly do, which is what we have employed on Mars for a long time now. And I'm really hoping that they do it before 2030 because that sounds exciting. They launch in 2030. It'll be 2037 by the time it gets there. God, who knows what'll happen by then? Not to be pessimistic, but the exploration of Titan opens a whole new frontier in the search of life beyond Earth. It challenges our Earth-centric concepts of life and habitability, presenting a world where life might exist in conditions that are unimaginable on our planet. In essence, life on Titan, if it exists, would be a striking testament to the adaptability and diversity of life in the universe. As the great Jeff Goldblum would say, life finds a way. My source is NASA, the Planetary Society, and the European Space Agency.
That is fascinating.
Something like that could actually evolve and exist. All the pieces are in place. It's just a different approach to it. Like you said, not carbon-based, but probably methane-based organisms, or orgasms, if you prefer. I said that one time when I was reading news, and I was just starting out in radio. We're doing a lot of radio stories here today. And it was a story about the red tide. And that is small algae-like creatures that invade the coast, turn the water red, and it kills fish and stuff. And it's happened a lot, actually, over the decades. And the line I was supposed to read was, the small marine organism. I said the small marine orgasm, and then proceeded to laugh, like, uncontrollably for about 30 seconds.
With news.
Yeah. Sports and weather next.
Now, you, if I remember correctly, you told me that you still remember the first line that you said on the radio, right?
I remember that I was reading news. I started out, like many people in broadcasting, reading news. And so, yes, the first story I read, boy, this is going to really date me. The first story I read was, the Senate Finance Committee passed a measure today that would block President Ford's $3 per barrel tax on oil imports for 90 days. That's right. President Ford.
That's amazing. I don't know how you remember that. It's wild to me.
There's all kinds of weird stuff stuck back there. With you, it's lyrics. With me, it's news stories. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. You know, as your kids get older, there are some things about parenting that gets easier. I remember once hearing my sister tell my little niece, if you put your pants on, I'll give you some Fresca.
And when kids can start to reason that they get something if they do something right, it's a lot easier to manage them.
Having that conversation about money with your kids, that's not the easiest thing in the world. Fact is, kids won't really know how to manage their money until they're actually in charge of it. And that's where Greenlight can help.
Greenlight is a debit card and money app made just for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on the kids' spending and savings, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills.
Your kids will learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to the games that teach kids skills in a fun, accessible way.
When I was a kid, I had expected chores, and then I had bonus chores. And bonus chores were where I earned money. And so if you're thinking like, hey, my kids should be doing stuff around the house, yeah, no, you're not wrong. But maybe there's extra ways that they can learn how to be a successful financial money person.
What was one of the bonus chores that you had to do?
Rub my mom's feet.
And what did that pay?
I don't know, like a quarter or something.
Millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate their life together.
Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/oddities. That's greenlight.com/oddities to try Greenlight for free.
Greenlight.com/oddities.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
And we're back. all of these old radio cliches coming back to mind. Do you have a story for me?
I do, as well as plenty of free parking.
And friendly, knowledgeable service?
Yep.
Okay, good.
This one's a little heavy, so just bear with me and be aware that some of it is a little upsetting.
Okay.
Child kidnapping. So you can see already, we're starting with something not fun. Child kidnapping has plagued China, as in so many other places, for many years. Some of the children taken from their families have been exploited by criminals, being coerced into activities such as begging, pickpocketing, forced labor, or, of course, involvement in the sex trade. The one child policy in China, which was in place from 1979 to 2015, contributed to the kidnapping problem in that country. The policy led to a preference for male children, resulting in a significant gender imbalance and creating a demand for kidnapped children especially boys, to be raised by families who wanted to ensure their family line continued.
So it's the classic supply and demand,
yeah,
but horrible?
Yeah, except the demand was pressured by this one child policy and also a real misogynistic, patriarchal kind of scenario where boys were preferred and demanded in some cases.
Patriarchal actually sounds like a delicious frozen snack. Available now in your grocer's freezer. Ask for it by name. Patriarchal.
That would be nicer than the reality of it.
Mm.
So this exacerbated the issue, making it more challenging for families to recover their missing loved ones. Now, under China's one-child policy, couples desiring for a son for lineage caused this problem to just explode. Persistent attempts for a male child led to penalties and denial of social benefits for additional offspring. With boys being more valued than girls, girls were commonly abducted for labor or as brides for unmarried sons. In 2017, the U.S. labeled China as one of the leading human trafficking offenders. And even family planning authorities partook in the abductions, utilizing their authority as people in that field to seize children from parents, surpassing their allotted quotas.
This is horrifying. And I'm wondering if this ties in with the black market organ theft that is so prevalent in that area, too.
Interesting thought. In 1988, Mao Yin was one of the children who fell victim to abduction. His mother, Jing Zi, employed at a grain exporting company, had to travel out of town during harvest periods to meet with rural suppliers. And during one such trip, Mao Yin, nicknamed Jia Jia, was left at home with his father. Jing Zi got a telegram from her employees with a brief message. Recalling the situation, she said, during that period, communication methods weren't as sophisticated. So she received this 6-word telegram that said, emergency at home, return right away.
Well, that's not something any parent or person wants to hear or read.
Yeah, horrifying. After picking up Jia Jia from kindergarten, his father had briefly stepped away to fetch a cup of water for him at a family-owned hotel. And in the span of just a few minutes, the 2-year-old had disappeared. Unaware of the pervasive child abduction issue in her country, Jing Zi initially believed that her son had simply gotten lost. And the thought that they wouldn't be able to find him didn't even cross her mind. And of course, when he disappeared, the father and police had searched the vicinity. Jia Jia was nowhere to be found. Jing Zi went back and searched again when she got home. She then created flyers featuring his photo, distributing them near the railway and bus stations, and also posted missing persons notices in local newspapers, but to no avail. Jing Zi and her husband spent the following years searching for their young child. Over time, their all-consuming focus on finding him led to a lack of communication between the two about anything else, and this ultimately resulted in their divorce after 4 years. Now, studies show that that's incredibly common.
Yeah.
People who lose a child to death or kidnapping, that significantly increases their likelihood of divorce.
Yeah.
Despite this, Jing Zi remained unwavering in her search. Every Friday after work, she embarked on train journeys to neighboring provinces in pursuit.
And this went on for years.
Yeah. She would return home on Sunday nights to resume work Monday mornings. Whenever there was a potential lead, news of a boy who looked like Jia Jia, she would diligently investigate. And she eventually quit her job to continue her search.
Wow.
One such search, following a lead on a boy who reportedly looked like her son, who had been adopted from their region, she hopped a long-distance bus, followed by a countryside bus to track down the family. But she waited all day for villagers to return home from the fields, And she discovered that the couple had already taken the boy to another city. So she rushed to that city, arriving in the wee hours of the morning, searched and searched, eventually discovered where the couple lived. They lived in a rented apartment. And when she got there, she found that they had left town 2 days earlier.
Okay, so suspicious? Did they get tipped off?
Maybe.
Are they actively trying to avoid her, or just a bizarre coincidence?
Well, she went to the town that their previous landlord had said that they had gone to.
Right.
So she arrived in the middle of the night. She scoured hotel after hotel in her pursuit, and she finally found the hotel that they had been staying in, and they had already checked out.
Okay, all right.
So persisting, she journeyed to another town to find the husband's parents, but they weren't there. So desperate, she went to the wife's hometown. And she, at this point, she had gone days without proper rest or meals. She did locate this woman's family and was able to track down the couple and this child. And it wasn't her son.
Oh, no.
You can imagine the stress and the disappointment and that emotional roller coaster where you feel like you're almost there and then it turns out to not be it. Jingzi had to be hospitalized at one point because she found it so difficult to balance her efforts and self-care. Eating and sleeping, thinking about anything else became second to her search. She appeared on television to appeal for help. She met with other parents whose children had gone missing, not just in her province, but further afield, and she began working with them. They formed a network spanning most provinces in China. And in addition to her on-the-ground efforts, when the internet became a thing, she utilized that as well as social media to broaden her search. After her son had been missing for 19 years.
What?
Jingzi embarked on volunteer work with a website called Baby Come Home. And this is the largest charity aiding families in the search for abducted loved ones. Baby Come Home has documented nearly 36,000 cases since 1978. And that suggests that the actual count is significantly greater.
Yeah.
With numerous volunteers aiding in this search, Jingzi felt a kinship and said that she no longer felt lonely. She found solace in the aspect that even if her child wasn't found, she might be able to help in somebody else finding their child.
Wow.
Jingzi's endeavors reportedly contributed to the reuniting of 29 other abducted children with their families, all while persisting in her quest to find her own son. In 2009, the China government established a DNA database for couples who have lost children and suspected that they may have been abducted to register their genetic information. In April of 2020, a breakthrough led to a lead regarding a man who had been abducted from Xi'an, their hometown, many years before. Through the use of advanced facial recognition technology, the police pinpointed his whereabouts approximately 430 miles or 700 kilometers away from their hometown in the neighboring Sichuan province.
That's remarkable.
Subsequently, the man was persuaded to undergo a DNA test, and it was a positive match.
It had been how many years total at this point?
32 years.
32 years.
Over 300 false leads, 32 years. On May 10th of 2020, which is Mother's Day in China, police told Jingli that they had found her son. And they met 8 days later.
What was that like, I wonder?
I can't even imagine. I've already read this and rewrote it, and I still have goosebumps,
yeah.
Even though,
yeah.
Like, I'm familiar with what happened.
I mean, that must be just such a mixture of emotions. First, you know, relief and happiness and joy, and then maybe the thought in the back of your mind that this is a grown man now. Maybe he doesn't even want to have anything to do with me.
Right. He was a grown man with his own family. He had kids. And he was completely unaware that he had been the subject of an extensive decades-long search.
Wow.
Jingzi later discovered that Jia Jia had been sold to a childless couple for 6,000 yen. That would be about $840 in today's currency.
Wow.
Now, he prefers not to be interviewed, and police aren't revealing information about his adoptive parents. It's entirely possible that they had no idea that he had been kidnapped. Following their reunion, Jia Jia spent about a month in their hometown, dividing his time between his birth mother and his birth father, getting to know them and going through pictures and talking about everything that had happened in the 32 years since he was abducted.
That's crazy. So she's out there every weekend for 32 years. And what was he doing?
He went to school. He was an interior decorator.
The father, the biological father.
Oh, I don't know.
He was just happy to let her look.
Well, they had divorced, as I said, and maybe it was just too much for him. I mean, I can imagine after a certain amount of time, you have to kind of give up the ghost or you go friggin' crazy.
Yeah.
So everyone grieves and deals in different ways.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound judgmental because I don't know how long I could deal with it. I would have to at some point, not 32 years later, but at some point, let it go.
Yeah.
So good for her.
Well, Jingzi could not, and she found her son.
That's a very happy ending. It started out,
I know,
in the most terrible fashion possible, but well done.
I got my information from the BBC, from The Guardian, CBS, and Daily Mail.
And now, that thing in the middle.
Thing in the middle this time. These are five fads that, looking back in time, weren't so great.
No, not so great. Number five, raccoon fur coats. Why though? It was a big deal in the 1920s. It started off as a fashion trend among college men to deck themselves out in a full-length raccoon coat.
Yeah, what is that all about?
I don't know. Eventually, the idea became unpleasant.
Yeah.
No, the idea was always unpleasant, but pretty soon it became associated with pimps, so people stopped doing it, thank God.
You see old photographs of the 1920s, and they'll be in like an old Model T Ford wearing one of those, a straw hat, and they'll be saying things like 23 Skidoo.
Yep.
Number four, in Victorian England, limps were all the rage. You know, like you hurt your knee or something. Known as the Alexandra limp, fashionable ladies of the time adopted this wobbly stride in honor of Alexandra of Denmark, who had married the Prince of Wales. She was already a fashion trendsetter, so when people started seeing that she limped, then, well, they had to limp too.
It's like blacking out your teeth because the well-to-do were the only ones who could afford sugar.
Yep.
Number three, flagpole sitting. Now, this is not a euphemism. It was actually a thing where you'd climb to the top of a flagpole. The higher and more dramatically placed, the better. And the longer you sat there, the better it was.
It seems like a lot of this stuff came from the 20s and 30s. And I think in the 20s, there was an overabundance of everything except alcohol. And then in the 30s, there was an underabundance of everything except for alcohol. So it's people were looking for weird shit to do, I guess.
It's wild because a lot of this seems like it would be inspired by alcohol.
In 1939, at Harvard University, a new fad started, swallowing live goldfish. A freshman bragged to some friends that he'd once eaten a live fish, and I don't think they believed him. And Harvard, being a hallowed institution of higher learning, they immediately bet him $10 he couldn't repeat this feat that he claimed to have done. And it would have stopped there, but a reporter picked up the story, and who knows why, but they did. So the student ate the fish, made his $10. The reporter wrote the story, and then it went national, and it just became a craze. And not just one goldfish. there were people who would try to set records of how many live goldfish they could actually swallow.
That's how I got goldfish. When I went to school years ago, I moved into an apartment, and the girls that were moving out of the apartment had these fish in this filthy tank. It was disgusting. And I was like, hey, what's the deal with these goldfish? And they were like, we don't know. We just got them from a frat event after some boys threw them up.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
And I was like, you could just leave them. Don't take them. Just leave them. I will take them.
Oh.
So then I had them and I named them Bill Excellent and Ted Adventure. You remember Bill and Ted?
I do. Yeah, I do.
And I had them for like 6 years. They lived a long, happy life after that.
I'm amazed that they weren't damaged just by being in the stomach for even a short period of time.
Probably emotionally they were.
I would think so, yeah.
And number one, phone booth stuffing. Once upon a time, there were phone booths all over the world, and it became a thing for a while in the 1950s to see clown car style how many people could get into a phone booth.
Yeah, I remember seeing pictures of stuff like that. I don't understand why people do things, but it's really, I guess, not any different than like the Tide Pod Challenge, except that's more dangerous. There's always something, it seems.
There's always something.
Something stupid. You put the word challenge at the end of it, and people will do it. It doesn't matter. So we're going to start our Send the Box of Oddities Your Money Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a wild one.
Yeah, it's kooky.
I need it to pay for a hotel.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
In a recent episode, you were talking about how I enjoy the idea of exploring old abandoned buildings, especially if they were institutions. Yeah, I'll sit and watch YouTube videos of people breaking into old abandoned houses and...
Not breaking in, just going in.
Not breaking anything. They all seem very respectful. But in the heart of Kempton Park, which is a suburb of Johannesburg, South Africa, stands an abandoned building that has stirred the imaginations and the fears of locals for over two decades. It's the Kempton Park Hospital, which abruptly and with no explanation was shut down the day after Christmas in 1996. No warning, no explanation. it's since become a hotbed of eerie tales and paranormal speculation. The sudden closure of the hospital is one of the most intriguing aspects of this story. It was operating fully until the 26th of December, 1996. And then the hospital was seemingly abandoned overnight, leaving behind not only medical equipment and files and records, but some more macabre relics like body parts in the morgue and blood samples. Why the hospital closed so abruptly remains a topic of speculation. There were rumors that it was maybe financial mismanagement or shifts politically that may have played a role. Yet no official explanation has ever clarified the reasons, which adds a whole other layer to this story. But we do know that this hospital did have a bit of a dark history.
Oh my.
The hospital once was a cornerstone of this area. When it opened its doors in 1976, it quickly established itself as a vital institution dedicated to serving the local community. The hospital was equipped with state-of-the-art medical equipment. A wide range of medical needs were handled, from emergency services to specialized care, and it flourished. It grew alongside the community that it served. However, its commendable history was tarnished in the early 80s through the early 90s by one of the most chilling fraud cases in medical history involving a guy named Andre Esterhazen. Andre, a high school dropout with a cunning ability to deceive, posed as a pediatrician, a role through which he exerted a profound and disastrous influence on many lives. Under the guise of medical expertise, he undertook treatments on vulnerable infants, actions that would have lasting repercussions. His unauthorized and unskilled interventions led to a series of medical tragedies, including the deaths of infants, which shocked the community when it came out. His deceit not only endangered individual lives, but also undermined the trust of medical professions within the area. The revelation of his fraud was in 1992, and the subsequent conviction brought to light his heinous acts, casting a very long shadow over the hospital's legacy. He got 18 years for it. He was a guy, high school dropout, but a very good con man, and somehow convinced people that he had a degree in medicine specializing in pediatrics, and carried it off for 10 years.
And it doesn't sound like his goal was, like, I'm going to make a ton of money. He just wanted to, what, pretend?
Yeah. Now, this undoubtedly played a part in the hospital's abrupt abandonment, but it was still a few years before it happened. The abandoned Kimpton Park Hospital, as I said, closed in 96, and it's like a time capsule in there. It's just like people left. There was no moving equipment out or files or anything. It was just deserted. And its morgue particularly embodies the eerie aftermath of its sudden desertion. Within the walls of the morgue, there's a collection of artifacts that was left behind, untouched and decaying amidst the hospital's hasty closure. It houses dust-covered jars and containers filled with preserved human organs and assorted tissues. And these specimens, typically were used for diagnosis, education, or research, have instead become relics of neglect, contributing significantly to the haunting atmosphere of this hospital.
Yeah, bits and jars will do that.
Yeah. I found a picture online of an urban explorer, and he was holding in his hand a jar with a kidney in it.
Oh, thank you.
Besides the jars, the morgue still contains the rusting frames of autopsy tables and their surfaces stained with the residue of past medical examinations and procedures. Nearby shelves and cabinets still full with old medical tools and equipment, scalpels, forceps, and other implements that were used in the dissection and the examination of bodies. These tools, even though they're corroded and covered with dust, are still laid out as if they're waiting for their next procedure. That's how quickly everybody left. The presence of old patients' records are scattered throughout the morgue, and that adds a whole different layer to its ghostly ambience. These files, which should have been secured or destroyed according to privacy laws, remain unguarded stories of the lives once connected with the hospitals, and they tell the tale of ailments and treatments and surgeries, just frozen in time and left for the curious who venture inside to just browse through. The unusual preservation of medical and organic material is not only morbid, but highly unusual, and it's turned the hospital, and especially the morgue, into an accidental museum of medical history. The disarray and decay of these artifacts foster an environment that is ripe for ghost stories, of course, and it draws people like me who want to explore it. I would so explore that hospital.
Why has no one cleaned it up? Like, some of this, I imagine, is like biohazard material.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Why are we not doing something about it?
Nobody really has an answer for that. There was actually a movement at one point not too long ago where a group of people wanted to reopen the hospital because they could use the additional medical facilities. And that just kind of went nowhere. And then another developer proposed that they turn it into retail space. Can you imagine that being a mall? That's fallen on deaf ears. So Kimpton Park Hospital is a destination for those who are seeking to connect with the spectral residue of history. And I think that's a good way to put it, because it doesn't really have to be a real supernatural haunting for there to be this sense of fear there, just the decaying artifacts and the silent stories that they hold.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be haunted for it to be haunting.
It's known, though, as one of South Africa's most haunted sites, and it's been the subject of numerous ghostly encounters and paranormal activities. One of the most frequently reported phenomena is the sound of babies crying in what was the maternity ward. This particular occurrence has been noted by various visitors, especially in that part of the hospital where the maternity ward was once housed. They say that the emotional energy is presumed to be particularly strong due to the tragic outcomes associated with André Esterhazy.
Yeah, I don't like it when regular babies cry, let alone ghost babies.
Ghost babies are terrifying. These auditory hallucinations are often described as being so vivid that people will go looking for the source. They think there's a baby that needs help, only to find empty rooms and silent corridors. Another chilling encounter is the sighting of a nurse dressed in 1970s nursing attire. Multiple witnesses have reported seeing this apparition wandering through the corridors, often appearing to be checking on rooms or standing by windows, just looking out as if she's waiting for someone or something. The figure is generally described as benign, but it adds a deeply melancholic layer to the hospital's story. Cold spots are another common experience among those who explore the hospital's layout, but that's never really been too convincing to me. We're talking about a building that's been abandoned for nearly three decades. Of course it's going to be cold. But perhaps one of the most unsettling occurrences is the sound, and this is weird, of a cardiac monitor beeping from empty rooms.
A machine that goes ping?
This has been reported primarily by those who visit late at night or early in the morning hours. The sound is described as intermittent, sometimes leading the curious or the brave to follow the noise. But when they get to the room, they can still hear the noise, but the room is completely empty and devoid of any operational medical equipment. The allure of Kimpton Park Hospital lies in its blend of real history and urban legend. For thrill seekers or urban explorers, paranormal enthusiasts, it offers a rare glimpse into a forgotten world where the line between the past and the present is blurred. And the stories of Dr., I am using air quotes, André Esterhazy, in the countless unexplained experiences reported by visitors, give the hospital a very chilling allure, and it's irresistible for, well, somebody like me or anybody fascinated with history, unexplained phenomena, and abandoned buildings. For those interested in the psychology of fear and the supernatural, This place serves as a case study in how places associated with death and tragedy can evolve into cultural icons of the paranormal. It reflects a collective fascination with death, the unknown, and it's embodied in a place many people believe is caught between this world and another world. So whether one believes in the ghost stories or not, the hospital's abrupt abandonment, the artifacts left behind, and its dark history conjure a narrative of a once thriving institution now remembered just for its eerie silence. As it stands, the hospital continues to captivate the imagination and stoke the fears of those who dare to walk in its, quote, haunted or slash haunting halls.
Well, I think regardless of whether or not there's hot 70s ghost nurses walking around, there's still something really interesting and intriguing about the idea of those lives and the life of the hospital still being there, regardless of its being closed for all these years, like the paperwork that's still there. And like you said, the tools left out for surgery or whatever.
Yeah.
The life that did live there, I think, is still interesting.
It is.
Regardless of,
it's fascinating,
as I said, hot 70s nurse ghosts.
My source is the Kempton Express. Legal documents and news archives detailing the crimes and trial of Andre Esterhuizen. Also some eyewitness accounts from paranormal investigations and visits that were recorded at the hospital and reported on paranormal forums and documentaries. The pictures that I have seen online of this place, it's nightmarish. It's just nightmarish.
I'm sad that we don't have our two-shot camera with the TV in the middle so we can share pictures. Also because the outfit that I'm wearing is fabulous.
There will be a video version of this, but I will insert the photos over our faces.
Okay.
Okay.
But what about my outfit?
I love your outfit, and we should have pointed it out earlier. Although, I think you'd look amazing dressed as a 1970s nurse.
All right.
Hey, Matt. Did you know that wombats poop cubes?
Nope. Never heard that before.
Did you know the unicorn is the national animal of Scotland, Ken?
I didn't know, nor do I care.
Neil. Did you know that Liechtenstein is the only doubly landlocked country in Europe?
Jeff, isn't that an American pop artist?
Well, actually, it's both. If you want to learn things like that and more, join us each week on Triviality, a pub trivia-style game show podcast where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Listen in each week to answer general knowledge trivia alongside exciting guests from around the world.
And we're here too.
Join us every Tuesday for new hour-long episodes of Triviality, plus tons of extra theme content on everything from The Office and Lord of the Rings to science and geography.
And sometimes we even do sports.
Find us on all your preferred podcast apps and take part in the fun of playing bar trivia without the need to wear pants.
Real mature, Jeff.
Forget it, Neil. It's Triviality.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. And about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today. And join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode where I'd like to tell you a story.
Box Wars.
Dateline, Bangor, Maine.
Have you ever heard of Box Wars?
Box Wars?
Box Wars.
No.
Sam Porter sent me this topic like a really long time ago, but I'm getting to it. God. Box Wars is a Australian event, and it's very unique. It involves participants creating elaborate costumes, props, and sets out of cardboard.
Uh-huh.
And then engaging in mock battles and performances.
With your boxes.
With your boxes. The concept of box wars originated in Melbourne. I think that's right. I don't want to get yelled at. It's not Melbourne. I know that much. But I may be over Melbourne-ing the Melbourne.
Forgive us, Australia.
Somewhere in between Melbourne and Melbourne. It was the late 1900s, and it has since gained popularity both in Australia and internationally. The founders of Box Wars, known as the Box Wars Supreme Overlords, have been the driving force behind the concept and evolution of Box Wars since its inception. Haas and Ross Coger, the Supreme Overlords, are credited with the development of Box Wars. The inaugural Box Wars battle, now recognized as Box Wars 1, the beginning, took place on January 26, 2002. It began as a forum of creative expression and social commentary, but it was mostly just fun. And it originated as a spontaneous event among friends who built armor and weapons out of cardboard boxes and staged mock battles. So two engineering students, of course they were engineering students.
Of course.
Mark and Ross were goofing around. They were smacking each other with foam pool noodles. And they thought, gosh, this is more entertaining than it should be. They got all hyped up after their battle. They were like, you know, And then they thought about how much fun it would be if a bunch of people got together with pool noodles and, you know, beat each other up with them. They're not wrong. So they fast forward a few months and Mark and Ross and Luke were chilling in the park when they spotted kids beating each other up with cardboard boxes. And of course, they were like, yes, let's get in on this box fight action.
They were like, dude, check that out.
No. They started thinking, like, how much fun would this be if everyone had cardboard boxes and they made cool armor and weapons out of these boxes?
Were they hot boxes?
No, stop. Maybe. So the difference here is that a lot of people have great ideas and then they stop right there at that great idea. They're like, you know, it would be great. And then they move on with their stupid, boring lives. And instead, these kids were like, let's get to planning.
Well, they were engineering students, so.
Right. So, of course, a lot of kids grew up making box forts, and these people got together and they used their previous experience, box fort building, and also being, you know, engineering students. And Josh and Luke and Haas and Mark and Ross formed the Box Wars Council. They laid the groundwork for the epic Box Wars legacy. And it was the start of an incredible journey that would go down in history of cardboard-related sports.
Sure.
The concept grew, and people got into it. It was a way for them to channel their creativity, their humor, their sometimes frustrations with an inclusive and fun activity. Over time, Box Wars evolved into an organized event and gatherings, spreading to other cities and eventually other countries around the world.
This is international now.
It's international. Participants in Box Wars use cardboard boxes, tape, and other simple materials to construct intricate suits of armor, weapons, vehicles, even entire structures. And they're often large scale and highly detailed, resembling anything from futuristic robots to historical armor and weaponry.
I would like to get involved in this and build a giant cardboard Troy bunny, like from Monty Python. That's the first thing that pops into my head. A big cardboard bunny.
I love it. I'm in. Absolutely. Now, normally, Box Wars features battles and performances while participants are donned in their cardboard gear. And typically, the events will be held in public spaces like parks or community centers or event venues where the people can first show off their creative cardboard outfits and then engage in their activities, whatever those activities might be. There's often also music and dance and forms of creative expression that don't necessarily involve cardboard outfits.
Okay, so basically what you're describing is a recyclable Renaissance fair.
Sort of, but you don't have to talk medieval-like. It's not like Milady and all that business.
You could, though, if you wanted to.
I mean, you could. Absolutely. I mean, you could just every day if you wanted to adopt that. I'm about it.
I went through a period of time when I did refer to you as Milady.
You've moved on to poodle, though.
Yeah, well, I watched Twin Peaks again recently. But I also went through a phase where I referred to myself in the third person.
That's true.
Jethro's not happy with this. I'm going to bring that back.
Box Wars events have gained popularity in locations around the world. As I said, it started in Australia, and then it moved to the United Kingdom. There's events in Canada and the U.S., and New Zealand. As I said, it's a creative expression. It kind of reminds me oddly of the Penobscot River race.
Oh, the Kenduskeg Stream.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yes, the Kenduskeg Stream. Yes. Yes, the Kenduskeg Stream race.
Yeah.
Where you race down the stream, but the outfits and the boats themselves are...
Yeah, and it's like a 7-mile kayak course.
Not a lot of people finish it.
No, most people get dumped into the water at some point because there are some rapids and small waterfalls. And this is usually held in April, the 1st of April. And I remember one year it got snowed out.
Yeah, you know you're probably going to end up in the water. And It is April in Maine. Those people have a special kind of something going on, and I don't have it.
You don't want to be floundering about in the Kenduskeg in early April.
No. The events foster a sense of community, collaboration. Obviously, it's good fun, and it's entertaining.
Sure.
What are you going to do? I'm pro Box Wars.
I'm with you on that.
Thank you.
Maybe we should start our own chapter here in South America.
That would be amazing. I don't know how much cardboard we could get our hands on since we can't ship it in.
Oh, that's right.
I got my information from the Box Wars website, Box Wars on Facebook, and Reddit.
We should sponsor it, being the Box of Oddities. We could be the Box of Oddities Wars.
Oh my God, that's so fun. If the Box Creations themes were spooky, then I'm on board.
Okay, fair enough. Before we wrap this up, would you stand up and step back away from the camera so that we can show our viewing audience how cute you look?
The idea today was that you could just see my shirt because we don't have the two camera thing.
Right. I want to see what's below the top. Pajama shorts. All right. That's what I'm talking about. It's no 1970s nurse's uniform, but pretty nice. Well, we should probably wrap this up because I don't know if you can hear all the sirens and dogs barking in the background, but things have gotten really loud here in the last 15 minutes or so. We do appreciate you hanging out with us. We do have a newsletter now, and it's available. Subscribe by going to our website, theboxofoddities.com, and it's free. As I put on the little label, I said, subscribe now, regret it later. And I think that sums it up.
Plus, I've got to get up at 3:30 in the morning.
So yeah, that too.
Let's go.
So we'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Therefore, it's been requested by those to whom I report to beseech you for assistance. We ask but one thing of you, to provide a 5-star rating and a positive review. True, that is two things. However, 'tis merely a 5-star rating and a positive review. Also, subscribe to us. Okay, so three things is all we ask. Three things and three things only. Henceforth, the Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. theboxofoddities.com. Copyright 2024. All rights reserved.
Do you love history but hate when it's stuffy and boring? Well, look no further and join me, Katie Charlwood, your friend, the neighborhood social scientist and reader of books, as I delve into unsolved historical mysteries, murders by gaslight, and of course, women who have been misrepresented through all time. On Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello everyone, Stakuyi here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.